From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and what a week in Washington, the first full week of the Trump administration. So much to talk about. We asked Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd to sum it up.
It was just a week ago when President Trump took an oath on two Bibles and told the country change was coming.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Later that day, the 45th president made it clear he planned to undo the work of the 44th. Trump sat in the Oval Office with a burst of new golden curtains behind him.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
And signed an executive order to start repealing the Affordable Care Act. But if that's the future, the administration was also looking back.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
On Saturday, the new press secretary, Sean Spicer, got combative with reporters without even taking a question at the first White House briefing. And Trump kept up his defense of the inaugural crowd at CIA headquarters.
I looked out. The field was, it looked like a million and a half people. They showed a field where there were practically nobody standing there.
Photographic evidence just doesn't support the president. And we all turned to our dictionaries when Trump counselor Kellyanne Conway coined a new term.
Alternative facts.
To explain why the Trump team offered its own description of the day's events. There were also unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud and more presidential orders on abortion and trade. Plus, a few more to resurrect two of the most controversial construction projects in the country.
Dakota Access Pipeline.
And the Keystone XL.
Something that's been in dispute.
President Obama rejected it in 2015.
We'll see if we can get that pipeline built. A lot of jobs.
But it was a different order that got the world's attention.
Mexico no pagará ningún muro.
Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto said no way Mexico's paying for Trump's border wall. He canceled an upcoming meeting with Trump in Washington yesterday. But the American president said it was his idea, too.
Such a meeting would be fruitless, and I want to go a different route.
Which means there's one less thing to do in week number two. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Yeah, but we're going to look at that schedule. Boy, and you can add to this week, Trump's top advisor, Steve Bannon, telling the media to shut up, but then we couldn't have our politics roundtable. So let's do that right now. Bring in Rebecca Cinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
And Jesse Holland, who covers politics for the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
I'm good. And we can also add thousands in our gathering in D.C. to hear the Vice President, Mike Pence, address the annual March for Life rally in D.C., the anti-abortion march. The first time a sitting vice president will speak at that rally. So what a week. Jesse, you start. How would you rate it for Donald Trump?
Well, it's definitely been a busy week, if nothing else. He's been hanging on to his Twitter account and doing foreign policy on Twitter and signing executive orders. So anyone who thought that Trump was going to slow down with the weight of the presidency on his shoulders should have already figured out by now that that's not going to happen.
And when we watch him, Rebecca, pick a fight with Mexico over who's going to pay for the wall. And by the way, I'm remembering back to the campaign. It wasn't like there was a big groundswell of people saying, well, how are we going to pay for that wall? He came up with the Mexico is going to pay for it on his own. And now that they say that they don't want to do it, he's talking about this 20% border tax. But Michael D'Antonio, who's written about Trump, says he likes fighting with people. This is part of what he likes to do.
I think there's an element of that there. It's also kind of interesting to note, you note about the wall and the way it was used during the campaign. Of course, he actually met with the Mexican leader during the campaign and did not raise the topic of the wall.
Right.
Now he's in the position where he can actually do something about it. It has to be discussed. And it doesn't seem as though he's figured out a way to have those sorts of difficult conversations, for want of a better word. You know, he talked about being a master negotiator. But it seems to be something that he hasn't quite figured out to do when he's not in a position to dictate the terms.
Well, it's one thing, Jesse, to change your mind on something. Presidents are famous for swiveling, completely
right.
Spinning on topics. It's another thing to have perhaps inaccurate information, and that's, you know, this unsubstantiated belief that several million, 3 to 5 million people voted illegally in the election. Members of his own party, Republican secretaries of state across the country, have been telling him to back down from this. And this has brought a debate in newsrooms about the word lie. you know, how do you describe Trump's statements when they are completely unsubstantiated? NPR is not using the word lie because lie involves intent and we can't be inside someone's head. That's the reasoning. But I want to start with you, Jesse, at the AP. What are you using?
Well, like you just said, lie involves intent. And it's something we're not mind readers. We don't know what's going on in anyone's head. We can just tell you what the facts are and whether a statement by the facts that we have is right or wrong. And that's what we can do. But we can't delve into what someone's head and what they're thinking and why they're saying it. We can just tell you whether the facts are true or not. And that's what we do.
Rebecca, the Times is using lie. How about the Washington Post? Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, it's on a case-by-case basis. You have to say there's this huge focus on terminology and on semantics, and it kind of is a little bit reminiscent of the debate and the discussion that was around the use of the words radical Islamic terrorist. It's not as though these are kind of magic words. You want to describe accurately as you can what it is that's occurring, but the key is to let people know that the information is not correct if it's not correct. And using false is a pretty tough term. Lie, I agree, should only be used in cases where we can actually actively say we know that this person is aware that this information is inaccurate and they are using it anyway. You don't want it to lose its effectiveness. You have a feeling you're going to be pulling it out over the years. So, there's lots of different words that people can use to describe what it is we're seeing right now.
Yeah. As Peter pointed out at the top of this segment, so much has happened this week. And I just want to ask about immigration. This is obviously one of Trump's first priorities, and we talked about the border wall. He wants to step up deportations. He wants to increase border detention facilities and the number of border agents. But it does sound, Jesse, like he is backing off a little bit on the Dreamers, people who were brought here by their parents illegally and are here. Does it seem to you like the Dreamers should not be worried about being deported?
As he says.
Yeah. Oh, well, I definitely would not rest on my laurels if I was anyone at this point, because this White House seems to be moving back and forth so quickly on so many different topics that you don't actually know exactly what next week will bring. This week they may have gotten a little distracted by the whole border wall with Mexico, or they may have gotten distracted by Steve Bannon. So we don't quite know exactly where things sit with this White House yet, and this is just week one. So if I was I wouldn't get comfortable if I was anyone quite yet.
Yeah. Well, and let's look at what's happening right now. The annual March for Life happening in D.C. This is the anti-abortion march. Vice President Mike Pence, as we said, speaking the first time as sitting president, will do that. He's perhaps the most anti-abortion member of Congress by some calculations. And Kellyanne Conway is going to speak as well. She, of course, the president's spokesperson. Here she was this morning on Fox and Friends.
We just have to look at this as a culture of life. Many presidents and vice presidents have said they were pro-life. They were. But to have Vice President Mike Pence go out on that mall today in just a few short hours and address those who are coming around from the country and indeed the world to bond together to protect the culture of life is truly remarkable and historic.
Of course, this the week after the Women's March, which was historic in Washington. We'll see how many turn out today. But more important, this comes, Rebecca Cinderbrand, ahead of next week's announcement. According to Donald Trump, on Thursday, he's going to announce his Supreme Court pick. Obviously, it will be somebody, well, maybe not obviously, somebody who wants to overturn Roe v. Wade.
You know, it's been interesting to see, of course, Donald Trump's evolution on this issue over the years. At least at this point, he seems to know he's someone who can read a room. He was speaking to Republicans from the Hill this week, went to their retreat, and he spoke about a lot of issues where they don't quite wind up on the same page. But the loudest and longest applause he got was when he spoke about the Mexico City rule, the language, of course, that traditionally Republican presidents, when they come in, want to make sure that organizations overseas aren't advising people on abortion and so on. That was the issue that really resonated with Republican lawmakers. He knows that. He could sense that. And so on this particular issue, it doesn't hurt him in the slightest politically. If you're just speaking from a purely political perspective, it's something that he knows is a surefire gimme issue for him. And so it's difficult to see him swaying in any way from someone who is acceptable to the majority of the party on this issue.
Well, and obviously that's something he's not going to face pushback from Republicans over. But Jesse, just in the 30 seconds we have left, are they going to push back on him on other things? Because it does seem like they're really falling in line, the Republicans.
Well, one of the things that he has to worry about is this whole border tax for the wall, because traditionally, Republicans have been the anti-tax party.
Right.
And you're going to see people like the National Retail Federation say, wait a minute, you're cutting into business profits. You're raising taxes on the American people. That's going to be a hard sell in Congress.
That's Jesse Holland, who covers politics for the Associated Press, and Rebecca Cinderbrand, managing editor of The Fix at The Washington Post. So much going on. I think we're going to need to double the length of this segment for next week. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Next Tuesday is the last day for open enrollment for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and the future of the law is very much up in the air. Some Republicans are emerging from the GOP retreat this week in Philadelphia in favor of a combination of changes to Obamacare rather than one single replacement. The exact timing and details have not been hammered out yet. But the signups continue. One person who helps with that process is Laura Burbank, the ACA Projects Manager for Planned Parenthood's St. Louis region and Southwest Missouri. Helping people sign up for insurance is one of the services that some Planned Parenthood affiliates offer. Laura, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And what are you seeing right now in terms of people signing up? Are you seeing an increase in the number of signups as we near this deadline?
Yeah. Last year, we fielded over 6,000 inquiries from individuals and families who are looking for marketplace coverage and enrolled over 600 individuals and families in that coverage. And this year, we've seen almost a 15% increase when we were looking at our numbers before the December 15th deadline. Hmm. So people are very anxious and eager to enroll to have coverage for 2017.
Are people doing this because they think that something will happen to the ACA under Trump and the Republicans in Congress, and they feel like they want to get in before the deadline, or are they just ignoring the change in Washington?
There's always a lot of confusion and anxiety when it comes to something as dense and as complicated as health insurance, but without having a clear picture of the future, consumers are especially worried about what's coming.
You've also got people coming in that decide that they don't want to sign up for coverage. What's their reasoning?
Yeah, we've had some people come in and decide not to get coverage. Some people are not convinced that they need the coverage. Some people are concerned about the prices. And we have some other people who are coming in and are not convinced that it's going to be around in the future. And so they're opting to not get covered. But I would say that the vast majority of the people coming to see us are really looking to sign up and looking to have that health insurance.
What kind of questions are people asking this year?
You know, people want to know what's coming down in the future. They want to know how the Affordable Care Act is changing. They really want to know kind of what those changes are going to look like.
And what do you tell them?
Yeah, so what we can tell people is that we're really not sure what the future looks like right now with the Affordable Care Act. So, for example, we had a person come in who was saying that he's so thrilled that his son can be enrolled on his plan. His son was younger, maybe 22-ish, and was really surprised to find out that that was possible because of the Affordable Care Act. We also had another gentleman come in who was very excited about a complete repeal of the Affordable Care Act until he learned that his ability to get financial assistance for his plan and the prohibitions against denying people coverage due to pre-existing conditions were a result of the Affordable Care Act. And he was diabetic and had several heart attacks in the past. And so he kind of walked out of that appointment a little bit surprised and really committed to calling his representatives and letting them know that those provisions of the Affordable Care Act were things that he wanted to see kept in place.
But he was somebody who wanted the Affordable Care Act to be repealed before he knew that.
Yes. So again, a big disconnect. And I think this is really one of the first times that we're seeing that some people are seeing a direct result of policy decisions on their lives. And so there's still a lot of education that needs to be done around the Affordable Care Act and what the benefits are.
How important do you think the job of somebody like you is in how the Affordable Care Act works, to have somebody who is helping people get signed up for health coverage?
Yeah, I think the role that in-person assisters play is really important. We help individuals and families, you know, put in their application. But really, the bulk of the work that we do is helping people understand the differences between the plans, checking to make sure that their doctors are in network, helping them estimate the prices of their prescription drugs on any given plan, and really making sure that they have a good understanding of what they're getting enrolled in. We also do a lot of health literacy work with people, making sure that people understand the differences between copays, coinsurance, deductibles, and all those kind of health insurance terms that we see people struggling with a lot.
As we mentioned, you work for Planned Parenthood, which is an organization that we hear about in the news a lot. Republicans have been vowing to defund it. What's morale like right now at Planned Parenthood?
You know, morale is pretty good. We are a pretty industrious organization, and we are really committed to our mission of making sure that women and families have access to health care, especially reproductive health care. And so, you know, we definitely have some challenges in our future, but we're up to the task.
That's Laura Burbank, who is the ACA Projects Manager for Planned Parenthood's St. Louis region and Southwest Missouri. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to Texas now. There are over 400,000 Muslims living in that state. It's actually the fourth largest Muslim population in the country. And last week, 400 of them opened their mail to find a survey sent out by State Representative Kyle Biederman. It first laid out a discussion of Sharia law, then asked if recipients agreed with declarations from two Muslim groups against Islamic extremism. The third question in the survey asked if the Texas Muslims felt that the Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptian political group, which is considered extremist by some Arab countries, should also be designated a terrorist organization by the United States. We'll link you to the letter in the survey that Texan Muslims received at herenow.org. It was sent ahead of next Tuesday's Texas Muslim Capital Day. That's a day every 2 years in which Muslim leaders and lawmakers meet for workshops and education. And the survey was followed by a forum yesterday, which Representative Biederman said was to defend against radical Islamic terrorism. Sarwat Hussein is president of the San Antonio chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. She's also on the board of CARE. She joins us from San Antonio. Sarwat, what are people saying?
This letter is like a neo-Nazi type of letter, reminiscent of McCarthyism. It's very misleading, humiliating, intimidating, disgusting, and downright offensive.
What did you think when you opened it?
See, it is very common for our organization to receive things like this all the times by different people. But when I read and I saw it is coming from our lawmaker, it is shocking to see where he's wasting his time. If he wants to get to know the Muslim communities in the state and even around the nation, these are highly educated. Their children are not running on the streets or in the bars or in the gangs. I mean, the community should be awarded for that.
Well, the poll asks three basic things. Whether or not Muslims, you and others in the state, support the declaration of the Muslim reform movement. What is that?
We do not know. We would like to have the explanation. And where is this movement? The 8 million, 6 to 8 million Muslims in the United States have not heard of it.
Well, we're reading that this is a group of Muslims who met in Washington after the Paris and San Bernardino attacks, declaring, "We're Muslims who live in the 21st century. We stand for a respectful, merciful, and inclusive interpretation of Islam." They also are accusing Saudi-backed mosques of perhaps being involved in fomenting terrorism. So there is that group. But you're saying, beyond being asked if you support this group, you don't feel that anybody of any faith should be asked questions about their beliefs.
Yes. If we are a danger, show us the evidence.
What do you say to the people who say the evidence is in the several lone wolf attacks that have happened in the U.S. perpetrated by Muslim?
How many are several? One life lost is too many, okay? But if you say only Muslims are doing that, when only isolated cases have taken place, compare them with all the rest of the killings in the country. Muslims that have done this kind of thing, they should be punished.
This isn't the first time that a member of the state legislature there in Texas has made headlines for what some perceive as an anti-Islamic sentiment. In 2015, your state rep, Molly White, asked Muslims who were in town for the biannual Muslim Day publicly declare an allegiance to the country before being allowed into her office. Is there a whiff of that about these letters to you, this idea that it's almost a loyalty pledge?
These are just a handful of lawmakers. Instead of paying attention to the dire issues of the state, they are wasting their time by this fear-mongering.
Well, Mr. Biederman was just sworn into office on January 10th. He says the House leadership there approved his use of a committee chamber to conduct his hearing about the survey, but also he says he has the right to send it out on official paper. But others, San Antonio Republican Joe Strauss, the House Speaker, say that it's wrong to single out any group based on their religion. Do you plan on asking the state how they feel about somebody representing the state and sending a letter into your homes?
We are planning to continue with this, and this is not going to stop. We are going to continue with our fight, and we need the answers. See, the majority of the people are good people. We all are standing up together. It is just a few handful of these hate mongers. They are the ones who come forward and make the news.
That's Sarwat Hussein, president of the San Antonio chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Sarwat, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original Before You Go Toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Imagine you're walking outside and suddenly birds start falling from the sky, dead or dying. That's what happened recently in some towns in western Massachusetts. Residents thought it was the cold and were stunned to find out it was the federal government, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, poisoning starlings in towns across the country because they're a nuisance. Now, starlings were brought to Central Park, New York in the 1890s from England as an homage to birds mentioned in Shakespeare's Henry IV, but they spread quickly. Now they're invasive. Doing millions of dollars of damage to crops and livestock feeds, causing airplanes to crash, competing for habitat with native species. Bob Mulvihill is an ornithologist at the National Aviary in Pittsburgh, the country's largest. He joins us now from WESA in Pittsburgh. Bob, first of all, tell us more about how these birds are poisoned.
The poison is called starlicide, is the common market name for it, and it, you know, emphasizing it's really focused on control of European starlings. It also happens to be lethal to blackbirds of several kinds and crows. But it does have a very a short life. It's metabolized quickly. The metabolic breakdown products of the poison are not toxic, and it acts rather slowly. I guess it's anywhere from a day or two until the bird that consumes the feed is actually killed. But by the time it's killed, the carcass itself contains very small amounts, if any, of the poison that it was ingested.
So the USDA says it's safe for cats, owls, or other raptors. But then there's a question people still have, you know, killing creatures because they're an inconvenience. What do you think of the, you know, acoustic methods or, trained falconers can sometimes disperse birds?
Yeah. I think that when there is just a nuisance issue, that killing large numbers of birds is perhaps not really the way that we should be thinking about going. But, of course, I understand that for all the people who don't want birds to be killed, there are some very loud voices oftentimes telling the USDA that they want the problem solved. the acoustic methods and the, which is broadcasting loud distress calls of birds and so forth, or the use of a trained falcon by a falconer to drive the birds away, certainly can work, but it certainly is a nagging problem.
Well, at the very least, what we've learned from this story is that if towns are going to have the USDA come in and poison, they should tell the residents so that they understand why birds are falling from the sky.
I think that that certainly is true. That would go a long way, I think, to causing something like this to not be the story that it is. But I will say that the starlings, for a farmer, you know, who's working to make his living, you know, are probably not viewed in the same way that, you know, the big flocks lifting off, and they starlings are famous for creating those murmurations, which are those sort of gorgeous, you know, living sculptures in the sky where they just twist and turn and move. And that's actually a response to an aerial predator, and they're doing that to sort of avoid the predator. But it's a spectacle. It's a natural spectacle that's quite beautiful to see. There's no question about that. But again, if you're feeding your cows and your pigs and the birds are stealing a significant percentage of the food that you're putting out for your animals, and or if you're concerned that there's a possibility of transmission of disease to the animals that are your livelihood, it's a whole different matter.
Bob Mulvihill, an ornithologist at the National Aviary there in Pittsburgh. Bob, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
As we wait for more details on what President Trump plans to do on immigration, it's worth noting that more than 741,000 immigrants became naturalized U.S. citizens last year. Political commentator Andrew Sullivan was one of them. He writes about it in the latest issue of New York Magazine, where he's a contributing editor, and he joins us via Skype. And Andrew, this piece that you've written is in many ways a love letter to America. One of the things that you point out is that in your home country, the UK, it felt to you like the finest hour was in the past, but you didn't feel that way here.
Well, I came over, believe it or not, during the Ronald Reagan re-election, and it was such an optimistic, forward-looking time in America. And you grow up in England, and you can't help when you grow up there, and I grew up there in the 1970s, to see the decay all around you, to see an obvious national decline, which has shifted since, but that's what I grew up in. And to be born into the assumption, the national assumption, that our finest hour as a country was 1940, the Battle of Britain, and somehow we'll never regain that clarity or that courage or that nobility. And I think coming here, one felt the future was still open, that people were still optimistic, that they were still creating something that they hoped would be better than it had ever been before. And that's been true here, even though I think at the moment, and the Trump administration has made it rather poignant with its ramped up fear and sense of decline.
Well, and I want to get to your thoughts on the Trump administration, but you also talk in this piece about sort of how surprised and happy you are when you see people from all different backgrounds. You describe the boardwalk in Venice and Santa Monica with people of all races skateboarding and biking along the boardwalk, which I think is something that a lot of Americans take for granted, that you go to a dinner party and you may have people that come from all different countries, which is something that in other places you really don't see as often.
No, you don't. It's invigorating. I mean, for the minute I got here, the sheer diversity of people, the sheer variety of ways of life that I felt is pretty unique to this country. And to me, just a real invitation to curiosity, to openness, to being a better human being, actually. And I understand why some of that difference can be alienating at times, especially that we've had this huge surge of immigration in the last 30 years. So I see that fear here, but I was hoping with this essay to say, look past the fear and see the extraordinary dynamism and variety and diversity of this country as a strength, and see these differences as a way of figuring out what's best for human life in the future. And that, I think, is what America has always been, this great experiment.
All right. Well, that brings us to the Trump administration, and I want to listen to what you told us in October when we last spoke.
I'm terrified. I really believe that one of the candidates, Donald Trump, is a unique threat to peace in the world, to civil peace in this country, and possibly to our entire liberal democratic system.
You said that for you, this election was life and death for the Republic. Do you still feel that way?
I'm afraid I do. And the first week has been incredibly chilling and dark from the inaugural speech on. And the personality of this person who is now president revealed is so unstable, so impetuous and impulsive, so completely immune to learning anything, so rigid in his assumptions, which are based upon really what I think is a very distorted view of what the state of the world is and what the state of America is. I'll be honest with you. It's been hard to get up in the mornings. I love this country so much. To see so many of its finest traditions and norms and procedures and dignity violated on a daily basis, just all I can say is I'm feeling a kind of grief. I felt it a lot of last year when it was more like dread. Unlike a lot of people, I really thought he could win and felt that people were deluding themselves into thinking that this was an impossibility. And it gives me absolutely no pleasure to discover that I was probably right about that. And it gives me even less pleasure to see the darkest strains within America. I mean, this is the other thing I wrote about in the essay, is that America is this giant contradiction. It is everything I said about the future, but it is also deep down paranoid and afraid. And the fight, the struggle between those two forces of the very best and the very worst kind of defines this country's evolution. And I fear that we've just gone from what I believe to be the very best to what I also fear is the very worst. I don't think I've ever felt this way in my lifetime. I think this is different. And I really do think that in some ways it's a very deep crisis in the Republic that we are only just beginning to absorb.
Well, why do you think that he won then? Why was he able to convince enough voters around the country to vote for him to win the presidency?
Because fear is a very powerful weapon in political life. And there are buttons that you can press in politics, buttons of racial identity, buttons of nationalist fear, buttons of xenophobia, that most responsible politicians do not press. And I think also in a time of, for many people, extreme economic insecurity caused by globalization in part, I think the extraordinary shift in the demographics of the country, the ethnic demographics of the country. I mean, this would be, if we project forwards, the first white majority country ever to become a non-white majority country. That's a panic. There's an economic panic, there's a social panic, there's a racial panic, and he tapped right into it. Now, these things have, you know, there have been panics before in this country. There have been huge immigration crackdowns. You know, the proportion of the population that's foreign-born now is close to its historic peak, which is in the 1890s. About nearly 15% of the entire population is foreign-born. That's a lot for a country to digest. At the same time that the world economy is forcing Americans, especially those without college education, to really compete hard with many people from around the world. And they'll put all that together and add a tincture of, I will take care of you. I will fix everything. America first. And of course, you get a strong showing from this person. Even so, it wasn't a majority. So we're evenly balanced here. But at the same time, he has all the instruments of government at his disposal. And the opposition has very little, except now the free press. And that, of course, is something that Trump, as all authoritarians do, despises.
Well, that brings us to my last question for you, which is last time we talked to you, you were talking about how you wanted to break your addiction to online information, especially the nonstop yes. news about the presidential campaign. Have you stuck to that, or are you back to consuming news at all times?
Look, my goal was to, because I blogged every day for 15 years, meant multiple times a day, was to get sane again and to leave political journalism and to write about faith and to chill out a little bit. But look, history happens, and this is not something, I'm afraid, that any responsible political writer or writer at all can sit out. The question is, how do you cover this without going crazy yourself? So I'm trying not to get completely sucked in to the crazy news cycle we're in. But at the same time, I have to be part of this. I have to contribute. It's my duty. I took an oath when I became a citizen to defend the Constitution. And I will do my best, however flawed I may be, to do my now patriotic duty. And that means pursuing the truth, insisting on its validity, and opposing overreach of executive power and of authoritarianism. And however we can do that, slowly, empirically, calmly, relentlessly, we should do it.
That's Andrew Sullivan, contributing editor of New York Magazine. We'll link you to his piece at hereandnow.org. He's also a new citizen of the United States. Andrew, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
President Trump is expected to sign an executive order today at the Pentagon that will temporarily stop the flow of refugees into the U.S., and it may indefinitely ban all refugees from Syria. That will hit close to home in rural Rutland, Vermont, where the debate over refugees around the world has been playing out on a much smaller scale. In this blue-collar town of barns and cross-country skiing and 16,000 Vermonters, Rutland had been planning to take in 100 refugees from Syria and Iraq this year. Volunteers have been spending months gathering donated clothing, household items, and furniture for the new families. But opponents worry that the refugees will add to the local tax burden, and many wonder how well the newcomers will be vetted. Last week, the first two refugee families arrived in Rutland. Now they may also be the last Syrians to settle there, given President Trump's new plan. Nina Keck from Here and Now contributor for Vermont Public Radio had a chance to meet one of the families and has this report.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
I'm Nina.
I'm Hassan.
It's me, Nina.
Yes, you know.
Hazar and Hassam have barely spent a week in Rutland, but the couple was all smiles as we met in their host family's living room with an interpreter. They introduced their children, 9-year-old Layan and 7-year-old Mohammed. The couple asked me not to use their last names. They're new, they explain, and they want to be careful. I asked them what this last week has been like.
At first, we came here and we were surprised by the very, very warm welcome by the people of Rutland. And since then, it never stopped. People are just welcoming us and asking how are we doing and helping us in every way.
The couple are in their mid-30s and had been living in Damascus until 2 years ago. Hazar has a degree in French literature, but says she wasn't working because the children were small. Hassan, meanwhile, worked two jobs, as an accountant in the morning and as a sales representative for a medicine company in the evening. But they say their life in Damascus became unbearable.
The children were exposed to a lot of terror and the sound of bombs and the sound of bullets and the gunshots all day long. And we were like hiding and ducking underneath the windows and the tables all the time.
Hassan leans forward and tells the interpreter they wanted to find somewhere safe.
For your children?
Yes. I have family and children. My family. Yes.
The couple fled to Turkey, then applied for resettlement. That involved four separate interviews with officials from the United Nations and U.S. Homeland Security, two in Ankara and two in Istanbul, as well as multiple security checks. Then they waited. Both say that was the hardest part. They learned they were coming to America 5 days before they got on the plane. First, they were told they were going to Los Angeles, but at the last minute, that changed to Rutland. Hazar admits she was initially disappointed because she'd at least heard of Los Angeles. But now that she's met their host family, Greg and Maureen Schillinger, and their four children, she's grateful to be in Vermont.
But then when they arrived here and they got hosted by Greg and Maureen, they've been very, very, very happy and they're a very wonderful family.
Wonderful.
Layan and Mohammed haven't started school yet, but their parents say it'll happen soon. The children sit quietly until 11-year-old Michael Schillinger sets up a pair of mini hockey nets in the kitchen. Soon, all three kids are playing hard in their stocking feet. Greg Schillinger watches from the nearby dining room. Kids, he says, have a way of simplifying politics.
So often people talk about it in terms of policy or abstract idea. And, you know, and my question is, well, how many of these people do you know? I know four of them. And it's a loving mother and a caring father and two kids who just love to play games.
Hazar and Hassam say they both have close family back in Syria, which is hard.
So I try to call them as much as I can, but most of the times they don't have electricity, so it's really hard to get a hold of them.
When I bring up President Trump's plan to halt resettlement for Syrian refugees, Hazar nods. She's been checking her phone to see posts from friends she knows are waiting to resettle.
So she has one friend posted that I have like the permission, the flight permission, and I've been waiting for a long time. Is it possible that's like my, it's all going to stop all of a sudden?
Looking up from her phone, Hazar says through her interpreter, you can't imagine what it's like. Some of these families have been waiting 3, 4, 5 years, only to have everything stop overnight. For Here and Now, I'm Nina Keck in Rutland, Vermont.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.